When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Metal Mike here, and it's time for us to rock the night, people, because we've got Ian McHowland, the amazing drummer from Europe, with us. We hear what Europe's been up to, and we revisit the classic albums like The Final Countdown, Out of This World, and Prisoners in Paradise. Hey, are you digging the show? Well, consider being a supporter through Anchor. There's a link in the description. Now check out the interview.
Well, Ian, welcome to the 80s Glam Metalcast, man. How are you?
Thanks, man. Thanks. I'm fine. Thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. So you guys have been doing some shows, right? How's that been going?
Oh, yeah, that's right. We just did two shows in Finland, two festivals. And those are actually the first shows we do in, you know, 1.5 years or so. So it was a little, you know, like trying to learn to walk again. But I think we did quite fine, actually. The audience were great and supportive, and you know, the Finnish people, they just love their rock music, and so they were a great support, I think. But, well, you know, it's been a long time coming.
Yeah, I think as much as you guys are probably eager to get back out there, the fans are just as eager to hear music live again.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you can tell because people are, you know, Finnish people are usually quite wild, but they were a bit extra wild this time. So, yeah, you can tell that it's been, people have been, you know, longing for a long time now.
Oh, what's the COVID? How's COVID in, like, Sweden and Finland and where you are? How are the numbers?
I'm not sure about the numbers. I'm actually trying not to be too, you know, deep into that, because yeah, I think it's just depressing. You know, I'm just trying to hover above it and you know, hear the general news about it. But I think it's, from what I understand, it's kind of, you know, getting a bit stable in Sweden in any way. I guess most people are vaccinated, so it seems to be going the right way.
Yeah, definitely. What's going on with new music? Have you guys had, you've had some downtime. Have you been working on new music? Are there any plans for a new album in the future?
Well, I know that the guys have been writing new songs, but we haven't really tried out anything or you know, worked on anything as a unit just yet. But, you know, I spoke to Joey, and he had, you know, he said that he just started to get in the mood again to you know, start writing music. And I guess it's been, you know, kind of everybody's just been in their cave sort of for this 1.5 years I think it's more about trying to get you know, the forces together again and start being creative. But we definitely are talking about it, and I guess next year is going to be a lot more busy if everything is going the right way with a pandemic and everything. So I guess next year would be a good year to make new music. I mean, to record a new album and to get it out.
When you look back at your catalog, I mean, there's a lot of music there. I mean, is there a certain album that you gravitate to as your favorite, or do you like multiple albums the same? How do you feel about the catalog, and what's your favorite one?
Well, that's hard to say, actually, because I think there are a lot of great songs on all the different albums. I just went through, since I had some downtime now during the pandemic, I've, you know, gone through the albums and just to refresh in my mind about the music. And I have to say, there are a lot of pretty damn good songs there on every album.
So definitely.
You know, I remember just getting the feeling that, damn, we're a good band. You know, just like reminding yourself of that. But it's a tough one to pick up a favorite album. But I know that I tend to gravitate to for some reason Prisoners in Paradise.
Wow.
And I guess it's because that album was so sort of shoved away, because it was released just around the time when Nirvana came around and
exactly
and basically stabbed the 80s to pieces.
It's funny that you mentioned that one, because I was going to bring that up, but we can bring it up now. I really love that album, and I think you've kind of hit it on the head. You know, it kind of was just not the right time for that album, maybe, with everything that was going on. How was things like in Sweden? Did grunge catch on there right away, or was there, like, let's say if Prisoners in Paradise didn't sell that well in the United States, how did it do like in Europe?
Yeah, I think Sweden and Scandinavia was probably the you know, the region where that album sold, you know, quite okay. I think the album did worldwide just around 1 million, so mm-hmm. still it was fairly good, a good figure. I mean, compared with today's amazing, but
it'd be amazing
back
today.
Back then,
hello.
What the hell?
Hang on, do you hear me?
Yes, I just lost you for 1 second.
Yeah, I know that we had at least two of the songs from the album were quite high on the charts here in Sweden, and we also had one of the songs quite high on the charts in England. So you know, it wasn't that all that. You know, a total fiasco or so. But the problem was that the record company didn't want to push it because
right.
they were, you know, the grunge was the new thing, you know. So it was kind of unfairly treated, I would say. But then again, I mean, every band that was in the same from the same era, you know, went through the same treatment, basically. I mean, Sony Records that we had, our label released Alice Cooper's Hey Stupid,
yep,
and Judas Priest's Painkiller,
yes,
and Bad English Backlash album basically at the same time. So they, you know, they basically took the albums and threw it out the wall and you know, picked the one that stuck on the wall, sort of, and promoted that one. And all the other albums was just like swapped away, and Prisoners in Paradise being one of them. But also, I think, I mean, even though we had some success in Europe and in England, we just felt kind of burnt out at the time as well.
Because sure,
we had a lot of problems with the management, and also we had been touring for quite a lot, so we just felt like burnt out a little bit. So I think it was a sort of, I mean, the break that we took after the Prisoners of Paradise tour was inevitably, we had to take that because we were done. We were burnt out, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so many great songs on that album. Halfway to Heaven is amazing. Talk to Me. So many cool songs on
yeah.
there. And I think with maybe when you compare it to like something like The Final Countdown, you know, for some people, maybe they've heard Rock the Night or The Final Countdown too many times, you know. And when you go to something like Prisoners in Paradise, those songs are kind of fresh. You haven't heard them a million times. So, and they're great songs. And like I said, they haven't been overplayed. So it's kind of it's a nice gem in your catalog for sure.
Yeah, I think so, and it stands out a little bit because I remember when we did the pre-production for the album and we were sort of planning the recordings and everything, we wanted to basically rent an old theater and just use a recording mobile recording studio to record it, you know, set up the gear as we played live and just do it sort of all live, but without an audience. But obviously the record company, they didn't approve on that idea. So we ended up in a regular studio anyway. But I think still we were driven. We felt a very positive vibe going into the recordings of the album. But the problem was that during the recording of Prisoners of Paradise, Sony sacked most of the people that were working on the album. So when the album was actually recorded and finished to be sort of presented to the guys at Sony. The people that came from the A&R department to listen to the finished album, we never met them. They were like brand new people that were just hired. So they came into the recording studio. Okay, let's listen to your new album. And they basically didn't even know what Europe was about. Mm-hmm. So the only response we got from them was like, well, we don't hear any singles. You need to record more songs. Otherwise, we won't be able to promote this album.
Wow.
So the thing was that the album, so we had to go back into the writing, crib and try and write new songs, basically. So this resulted in the album being like more than a year delayed. So the problem was that during this year, the whole grunge scene took on. So it was, as you said, basically very bad timing.
Now, with the song, with the original run of that album that you had before they changed it on you, have you guys put out those songs in other ways, or where are those songs?
Well, the leftover songs were basically, I think we had about 10 songs that didn't end up on the album. And we used maybe 4 of those songs, you know, like B-sides and bonus tracks.
Okay.
But there are some other, I know that Key Marcello released 1 or 2 of the other songs that he, released on one of his solo albums. I'm not sure, but we haven't done anything as Europe with those songs. And I don't know if we ever will be doing anything, more serious about those songs, or if we just, I think we tend to lean to work on new material and focus on where we are today and bring that forth.
Yeah, well, it's too bad because this year is the 30th anniversary. It'd been nice to have a double album, and you have the original album remastered plus the album that the songs that you had in place before they made the changes. That would have been pretty cool for 30 years.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, the only recordings that are existing of those leftover songs are basically demo tapes.
Mm-hmm.
So they I wouldn't say that they live up to the standard to be released as a regular sort of release. But yeah, as you say, it could have been like a demo or bonus release or whatever, a double album. But we haven't heard anything we haven't been approached by any record company or Sony or any record label about doing that. So it's, mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, it's not going to happen.
And right now, they still own those original albums that you did on Sony. They still own all the masters.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. I think we're gonna get them, back in years. Uh-huh. I'm not sure exactly when it's gonna happen, but it will be happening in the future, and that will open up totally new possibilities to do something about the material and see if we can, re-release it.
Yeah, definitely.
Personally, I'm really in favor of those kind of releases because it shows the depth of the band and the songwriting and everything.
Yeah.
And I definitely think that many of those leftover songs are, as strong as, many of the songs on the album.
Mm-hmm. So now another album, well, this is the big, big album from you guys that was released 35 years ago, Final Countdown. Were you surprised how big this album became? Because, you guys have done a few albums before and, you had some success, but this was just like the breakthrough. I mean, were you guys kind of surprised when this happened?
Oh, yeah, man. It just happened so fast. Once it took on, it was just like a bomb going off. We didn't really have any time to reflect on what happened during the years when it actually was hot and high on the charts and everything. I think we just tried to hang on to the runaway train, basically, not to fall off. Everything just happened so fast, and it ha- it happened everywhere at the same time as well. So you know, the between early 87 and 89, it was basically a nonstop tour. So I think it wasn't until mid 90s that I started to reflecting on, gosh, what was that happen? Did I really experience this? It was really a rocket ride.
Yeah, and when, you know, MTV obviously played a big piece of this, you know, and 86 was just a big year for, like, the, you know, the glam metal or hard rock, 80s hard rock, whatever you want to call it. I mean, you've got Bon Jovi and Cinderella and Poison. I mean, everything was kind of exploding, and, I mean, MTV, you know, played Final Countdown constantly, Rock the Night, Care. I mean, you guys just was one right after another. So, I mean, MTV was a big fan was a big proponent of making this album probably as big as it was.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if Princess in Paradise is the worst timing ever, then the Final Countdown was the best timing ever. And that was the, in every sense, you know, we had all the right people, you know, in working for us, in the management and at the record companies. And as you said, MTV was just booming, and we were young and handsome, and we had a video director who could expose that in a favorable way, you know. So I think we gained a lot of success through MTV. I think we have a lot to thank MTV for our success.
Now, obviously, you came to the States a lot, you know, from, like you said, from 87 to 89. Had you played much in the States prior to the Final Countdown?
No, we never been to the, we were, the first tour we did in the States was in 1987, after the Final Countdown was released.
Wow.
And high on the charts. So, yeah, that was the first tour we did. And yeah, it was kind of spectacular. We had our own private jet and everything on the first tour, which was, yeah, it was really weird. But for some reason, the management and the promoter thought it was a good idea to travel by plane, because then we would have a lot of time to do promotion and radio stations and between shows, instead of sitting in a bus. And so, yeah, it was, we got a taste of luxury when we did our first tour in America. But it was a bit weird, because most bands, they tour, they do the dog years, you know, and before they even get their own tour bus. And so we were just, like, lucky, just riding in.
That's awesome. And then you get to Out of This World, another amazing album. I might say that I even like this album a little more than the Final Countdown. I don't know what it is about Out of This World that I like so much, but I don't know. It's just a really, just tons of well-written songs. Great album.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's I think in general, the song standards, overall standard, is higher than on the Final Countdown. I think so. The only downside, I think, with the Out of This World album is the, I think the production is a little too slick, a little too 80s.
Yeah.
It's a little too shimmery, too. But we had another producer on that album, Ron Nevison, who had earlier done Heart and Kiss, Crazy Nights, and a lot of those more sort of pop-oriented hard rock bands,
yes,
sort of, or productions, I should say. So, yeah, I think the sound is what lacks on that album. Otherwise, it's I think in general it's a better album than the Final Countdown as well.
Now, when you redid Open Your Heart and put it on this album, what was the thought process behind that? Did you feel like that was a song that maybe didn't get enough attention in the past, and you thought it had a lot of potential? Or why did you guys put that one on Out of This World?
Well, when we signed up for Sony Records for the Final Countdown, they also got the rights for the two first albums to be released. And somebody at the record company liked Open Your Heart, the song, and thought it should be. But, I mean, since Wings of Tomorrow, the second album, weren't really promoted in any way, they thought that it would be a good idea to re-record Open Your Heart for Out of This World, so it could be, you know, promote it as you know, as a new single, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we usually played that song live anyways. So it was, you know, one of those songs that we included in the live set. So it felt natural to just re-record it. And I think it turned out pretty okay. But again, maybe a little too polished for right. my personal taste.
Yeah, definitely. So now you kind of talked about after the Prisoners in Paradise tour, you guys took a long break, but you played with some other bands, right? You worked on other, so you really didn't stop playing. You did other projects and played with some other bands, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. I played with Glenn Hughes from Deep Purple.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it was me, John Levin, the bass player from Europe, and also Mick McAuley, the keyboard player from Europe. We all three joined that band, and we did. Well, a couple of European smaller tours, and we did a tour in Japan. Yeah, this was in 1994. And that was great fun because, to me personally, I mean, Deep Purple is one of my, you know, all-time, inspirations and favorite bands. And Ian Paice, I mean, he's one of the mentors for me when it comes to playing drums.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, being asked to play with Glenn Hughes was a huge honor to me, I think. So we did that Japanese tour, and we recorded a live album on that tour as well. So, and that was great fun. Recorded in Tokyo, it was a great honor to be playing those songs live, and actually, you know, being able to have those songs released with our versions of it. And I think we received a lot of good press from that album, from that live album that we did.
It's funny that you mentioned Deep Purple being such an influence, because I hear that for a lot of bands that came out of the 80s, especially bands that were from European countries, they love Deep Purple. So Deep Purple had a big impact, obviously, in that era, you know, in that time frame, because so many musicians I've talked to, Deep Purple always comes up.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for Europe, we start with the name Europe was taken from the Live in Europe, or Made in Europe, as the live album mm-hmm. is called, that Deep Purple released in, what was it, 1975, I think. So, even the name Europe comes from a Deep Purple album, and we're all, you know, really huge fans of their music and their as musicians and everything. So yeah, they're definitely with us in our, you know, like, you know, DNAs.
Mm-hmm. How about American bands? Were there any American bands that you grew up on as a kid?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, bands like Aerosmith mm-hmm. and Boston and Kiss, obviously, Journey. So all those bands were also huge influence. I think in general, the Europe were probably inspired by, say, Journey's melodic side
yeah.
and Deep Purple's more bluesier kind of aggressive side. So I think Europe had been taking, you know, different elements from different bands and American and European bands.
Did many American bands play live in Sweden? Were you able to see some American bands, or did you have to mostly see European bands live?
Well, I remember Kiss played in Sweden in 1975, just before they released Kiss Alive, or maybe it was, I'm not sure. Well, in 1970, no, it was in 76, just around the time when they released Destroyer, but
yeah.
they weren't very big in Sweden. They played on like a fanfare outdoors stage. And I know that Aerosmith played in Stockholm and Kansas played in Stockholm. So, and Ted Nugent as well.
Oh, wow.
But I don't think those bands were, and, you know, even half as big in Sweden, at least, as they were in America. So I think European bands were more bigger here in Sweden than bands like Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath.
Now, I read something the other day that in your early days, you jammed with Yngwie Malmsteen. Was that true?
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, I remember I went to a music store in Stockholm, and I was looking for a gig because my band had split up, and I saw this ad in the music store with saying Yngwie Malmsteen's Rising Force needs a new drummer inspired by Deep Purple and Paganini and Bach, whatever it was.
It's a strange mix, yeah.
I thought it sounded kind of interesting, so I called him up and went there for a jam session and sort of audition. And it was Yngwie and Marcel Jacobs, only those two guys from the beginning. I remember going down to this shitty rehearsal place. You know, it was like it looked like a bomb had gone off in a it was just trash and stuff everywhere. And this place was just big enough to have two Marshall stacks and a little shitty tiny drum kit there.
So even back then, he had the big amps and all that stuff. Wow, that's funny.
Yeah. So in any way, we jammed through a couple of Rainbow songs, and after that, Yngwie said, "Yeah, you're great. When you're gonna bring your drum kit and start playing with us?" And I was kind of, because they during the jam sessions, they had been fighting all the time, just screaming at each other, trying to outdo each other, you know, with playing loud, being the loud, who plays the loudest and who plays the fastest. So they were like cats, like a cat and dog in there. And I was from the suburb area outside Stockholm, kind of a shy guy, you know, so I felt really intimidated being there. So when Yngwie, he invited me to join the band, I said, I don't think I can take, because I've been offered a summer, working at in a store over the summer. So I can't take the gig. And I just went away from there, and he got really pissed off.
Oh my God, that's too funny.
But yeah, that's a weird story. Well, the funny thing is that this was in 1982 or 83, I think, before he went to the States and became sort of famous. And then I met him once again in 1987. This is like 5 years later or something, in a club somewhere. And he was like sitting by the bar, and he was totally fucked up. He was just like sleeping on the bar, totally drunk. So I went up to him and I tapped him on the shoulder and said, hey, Yngwie, do you remember me? And he looks up, you know, with the crossed eyes and just, you know, and he mumbles something like, "Oh, it's you, you know, the coward that didn't want to play with us," you know. So he was still mad about that, because I had turned down the offer to play with him.
Isn't that crazy? Now, would you have ever thought, like back in 82, that this guy, he really did become in the guitar world very big? I mean, you probably played in this little shitty rehearsal space. You probably couldn't envision that this guy would have went on to do, you know, great things.
Yeah, well, you know, we used to play before I went on this jam session with Yngwie, we used to play with, my previous band, and Yngwie and a lot of other, small rock bands from the suburb area of Stockholm. We used to play in small festivals and stuff together. Mm-hmm. So he was kind of well known around the Stockholm area as one of the greatest guitar players. But obviously you could tell that he was something else. He wasn't like any of the other guitar players. He wasn't a follower. He was a leader. While everybody else tried to sound like this and that and tried to copy whoever it was, Yngwie had a definite sound, you know, of his own. So he was unique. I think everybody could tell that. But then that he went that far as he did, I don't think anybody had any, you know, like could have guessed.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I can't imagine they would have. But hey, man, this has been great talking with you. I appreciate all the information and the stories that you shared. Anything you want to say to your fans out there in closing?
Well, we're just thank you for hanging in there and for waiting this, you know, crap out, and we will be out and we will be back and we will, you know, bring rock and roll back on the stage.
All right, Ian. I really appreciate your time, man.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Take care now.
Well, that was a blast talking with Ian. Now, there's lots more stuff on the way. I recommend you subscribe to the channel. Rock on!